You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There have been reports of an alarming increase in gang violence in once sleepy towns and communities on Long Island, and also growing hostilities between local and recently immigrated populations. Sarah Garland disputes some of the conventional wisdom about why violent gangs like Mara Salvatrucha and Salvadorians with Pride have migrated into America's suburbs in her book, Gangs in Garden City, which is published by Nation Books. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how did gangs like Mara Salvatrucha and Salvadorians with Pride come to settle and even thrive in these suburbs?
Well, with Mara Salvatrucha, that was a gang that had started in Los Angeles. It moved back to Central America in the 80s and 90s after immigrants were deported. And it came to the East Coast as immigrants moved to the East Coast following jobs. There was a huge construction boom in Long Island and around D.C. And as those immigrants moved in, they found that they were in towns where there was a lot of poverty. They were relatively isolated. And they were facing violence from other groups, other gangs. And so to defend themselves, they form these groups.
But we're talking about the suburbs. We usually associate gangs of this sort with the inner city, don't we?
Yeah, and it was very interesting. I started out this project I was working on research on gangs in Harlem, and I was a grad student at the time, and a professor said, you know, you should go out to the suburbs of Long Island, go out to Hempstead. I've heard of these gangs have formed out there, and they're getting a lot of national attention, so... So when I went out there, I was very surprised to find that indeed they're there.
And are they similar to the gangs we find in cities?
They are very similar. You go to Hempstead. When I first arrived there, it felt very much like walking, you know, off the train and into a poor neighborhood in the city, except that the architecture is suburban. You see small houses, cookie-cutter developments, but you have the same sort of poverty and the same sort of lack of businesses and so on there.
And what are these gangs doing? Are they fighting each other, or are they engaged in criminal activities of the sort that we associate with other organized crime groups based on ethnicity, like the mafia?
Well, I think they're fundamentally street gangs. So a street gang is
like the Crips and the Bloods.
Very similar, and there are one of the reasons that MS-13 and then later Salvadorans with Pride formed is because there were Crips and Bloods gangs in Hempstead. But just like the Crips and the Bloods, it would be very difficult to find a Blood member in Hempstead who had come from Los Angeles, for example, and started the clique there. For the most part, these kids had heard of these gangs through the media or through friends and said, you know, that gang sounds really scary. That's what we'll call ourselves, and that will make us, you know, sound tough and we'll be protected.
Do they have economic motives? Are they dealing drugs or extorting from people and local businesses?
I think there may be some of that. One of the interesting anecdotes, one of the teenage girl I follow through the book, she had joined the gang, and actually to make money as a 14-year-old, she may have been 13 or 14, they got her a fake ID so that she could get a job at McDonald's so that she could raise money for dues for the gang. So there is some drug dealing, and I think she had done a little minor pot dealing in her time, but she also got a job at McDonald's so she could raise money.
Yeah, I was expecting some kind of a criminal activity for the 13-year-old, but working at McDonald's?
Yeah.
How are they organized? Does the Long Island chapter of MS-13 bear any resemblance to the MS-13 group that's based in Los Angeles?
You know,
do the chapters connect with each other?
I think that there may be some communication. The police there, talking to the police in Hempstead, you'll get different stories depending on who you speak with, but the local police don't seem to think there's much connection. The FBI has talked a lot about the transnational nature of these gangs and communication going back and forth. But on the local level, you find most of the time these are kids who are forming these gangs on the streets, and they care mostly about the territory that they live in. There are several blocks of turf that they're going to defend, and they don't really think a lot about, you know, Central America or Los Angeles. They've never been. They don't necessarily know anyone there. So
why, as you write, does a place like Garden City remain comparatively safe and gang-free while Hempstead has a lot of gang violence?
Well, Hempstead is an older suburb, and I think that when you look at Long Island, there's a ring of suburbs that were built earlier in the 50s, and Garden City actually goes back just as far, but it was built as it was meant to be a very exclusive neighborhood when it was first built in the at the turn of the century. So it was built with very big yards, very big houses, and Hempstead is more of was always sort of a middle class neighborhood, and it began to deteriorate, just like any city neighborhood would do the same thing. After a while, the housing stock began to just get older, and so it became poorer, and people moved out. They moved further out to Suffolk County, to the other towns in Long Island.
And the statistics are interesting. Between 1990 and 2000, there was an 80% jump in Hispanic residents in the area. But you quote a local police officer as saying that these new immigrant communities in many ways have revitalized the area.
That's right. In the 80s in Hempstead, talking to the police and people who lived there, it was really, in a lot of ways, it had become a wasteland as people had moved out. Hempstead started as a white community, became mixed race, and then a lot of the white middle class had moved out and had left a poorer, and it became mostly minority and very poor, and there was a lot of drugs. The crack epidemic was there. And then in the 90s, you had Hispanic immigrants moving in, and they opened restaurants, they opened tax services, they opened bodegas. And, you go to Hempstead now, and it's poor, but it's also very busy, and there's a lot of businesses there.
Is there any way to estimate how many of the immigrants are legal or illegal?
It's interesting with especially with Central American immigrants, a lot are here legally. Some are because of they came as often they were able to get visas through the temporary protective status program. So there was natural disasters in Central America, and they were able to get papers that way. These are temporary. This is something that's extended every once in a while. But some are. A lot of them, though, weren't able to get that, and so some of them have come illegally. And one of the, interesting, a lot of the kids who I found who were tempted to join the gangs or got involved had come illegally alone. Their parents had come first and had worked to save money to reunite their families. And once they had enough money, they sent for their children. But they ended up having to send for them, and they would come alone across the border. So
although I'd imagine that the ones who had been deported from Los Angeles to El Salvador and then came back and are now in Hempstead, mm-hmm. Came in illegally. I can't imagine anybody allowing them into the country.
Right, yeah, and that's the case too. And I think there's different, I tried to, in the book, look at the three types of kids that are involved in the gangs. And you have the first generation immigrants who had come, that route, who had been deported and come back to the United States. And then you have the kids who'd been sent for by their parents. And then you have a lot of, at this point, a lot of American-born kids who are in Salvadorans with Pride, for example, is actually mostly American-born kids.
My guest is Sarah Garland. Her book, Gangs in Garden City, How Immigration, Segregation, and Youth Violence Are Changing America's Suburbs. It's published by Nation Books. So how did the gang Salvadorans with Pride form? They do grow out of a Los Angeles gang called the 18th Street Gang, don't they?
Yeah, they're allied with them. They ended up becoming allied with them. They actually didn't start as a gang. They started as a civic organization. They were going to help the immigrants who just arrived in Hempstead to take English. They had an idea of offering English classes. They marched in the local parade. And then and they tried to get recognition from the police, actually, to say we're going to be this civic organization. But they ended up having a dispute with MS-13, and that turned, they eventually became a gang that allied itself with the larger gang.
Now, not all the violence is between gangs. There has been some violence with just angry people, mm-hmm. for one reason or another. And there's been an awful lot of anger about hiring sites, hasn't there?
That's right. And I looked at violence, not just the gang violence, because I think that there's a link between the violence you find between the gangs, and then you also have a reaction to the Hispanic growth in Long Island. That
sometimes it just seems like it's a racist response.
Right, and I think that there, you know, with the there was a lot of displeasure and among people who'd been in Long Island when Hispanics started showing up, and they were day laborers working on the corner, and people felt unsafe by that, and so there was a contingent of people who were very who reacted, and it turned into eventually there was protests and so on, but then there was a few violent incidents directed at Hispanics, and that's grown across the nation. It's the racism against Hispanics has grown in the past few years.
Well, we associate anti-immigration activism with the border states, but isn't there a fair amount of it right out there in Long Island?
Yeah, very much so. And I think that that has acted because you have a very vocal anti-immigrant activism. You have the Hispanics are out there feeling very isolated and attacked, and that's one of the factors that I think leads to people seeking out gangs and as a form of protection.
Tell us about Marcelo Lucero.
He was an Ecuadorian immigrant. He was not involved with gangs at all, but he was attacked by a group of white teenagers. And what's interesting, I write about that because I think that it showed that the violence is not just a Hispanic problem or a gang problem, but there's also violence related to this new demographic, all of these new demographic changes in the suburbs that comes out of the white population as well. So it's not isolated to
Hispanics. Did you speak to the white population? Because you do talk an awful lot to people who joined these gangs mm-hmm. for this book.
I did, and I focused a lot on Hempstead, but I talked with the police and with the schools, and you know, the police are interesting because a lot of them have watched. They're from Hempstead. Several of them, they're from Irish and Italian and Polish families, and they've watched these changes. And particularly, one of the women that I met with, her son had been killed by gang members. He was 18 years old, her reaction. She was white, and her reaction was, extreme anger. She was very upset, and she became very vocal anti-immigrant activist. And she gradually changed as she met with some of the leaders in the Hispanic community and changed her mind. And she's now on the other side of things, saying, the best thing that we can do to stop this problem is fix the immigration system and deal with the poverty in these neighborhoods.
Well, some communities like Glen Cove seem to be able to accommodate these new immigrants more than others. Do they have better policies?
They had a lot of, in Glen Cove in particular, they had a struggle in the beginning in the 90s. They were one of the first communities to wrestle with the day laborers and how to accommodate them and whether to accommodate them. And they ended up, there was a lawsuit, and they ended up having to open a hiring hall. And that really diffused some of the tension because the day laborers were sort of off the street and had a place to go, and other people who'd been living there weren't as inconvenienced. And so they've had a lot more luck, and you've seen a lot less violence in that town. Other communities have not been so lucky.
Well, why doesn't everybody just follow Glen Cove's example?
Well, I think, there's been efforts to do that in some, but it especially, in Suffolk County, there's been more resistance. And it's Glen Cove, it didn't happen overnight. It took a long time. Because I don't know that everyone's still happy with the situation there, but it took years of struggle to get.
That's because Suffolk County is further out.
Right.
It's more Long Island, whereas Nassau almost feels at times to be connected to Queens.
That's right.
So they have more of perhaps an urban sensibility.
That's right.
Sarah Garland has reported on crime, immigration, and education for The New York Times, Newsweek, International Newsday, The New York Sun, Marie Claire, and other publications. Her book, Gangs in Garden City, How Immigration, Segregation, and Youth Violence Are Changing America's Suburbs, is published by Nation Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Sarah Garland, whose book, Gangs in Garden City, How Immigration, Segregation, and Youth Violence Are Changing America's Suburbs, is published by Nation Books. You talked to a lot of the gang members. Why were they so open with you?
Well, I started when I first got to Hempstead. The first place I went to was to the high school, and they were very open in letting me come and meet with kids there. And one of the first kids I met was he was 14 at the time, and at first very shy. But I was sitting with him in his school, so he's sort of in a safe place. And his teachers have said, you know, feel free to talk to her if you'd like to. And he really, you know, I think he opened up after a while. It took, you know, a little while, but he eventually opened up because I don't think that anyone had really asked him about how he'd come to the United States. His best friend had been murdered a couple of years earlier, and he just never had anyone to talk to or process that with. So I think that was part of it.
Well, people often join gangs because they feel a need to have some kind of sense of family.
That's right. And his friend who had been murdered had come to the United States. He had spent 9 years in El Salvador without his mom. She'd come to Long Island to earn money to make sure she could support him. And so he had had no contact with her until he was about 12 years old. So it was very difficult to transition.
And where are the parents of these children? Are they aware that their kids are members of gangs?
I think oftentimes they may not be. And the difference also in Hempstead, for example, than in El Salvador. In El Salvador, you have kids who are tattooing their faces and arms. And Hempstead, it's really not, you know, all of the kids sort of dress the same at high school. They wear the droopy T-shirts and pants. And so I think it's difficult, but they're also working a lot. So it's, you know, oftentimes I think that they don't have the time to sort of figure.
Well, you tell the stories of Daniel and Jamie. Mm-hmm. They come from similar backgrounds, and yet they wind up in opposing gangs. And then Jessica, in her case, gang allegiances even seem to divide families.
That's right. And she had a very, you know, she had a very abusive experience in childhood. And so her whole family was a member of MS-13, all of her uncles and her cousins. And partly because of that abuse, she ended up joining the opposite gang because she was looking for a new family. She'd had such a terrible time growing up. And no one, you know, in school, no one really noticed. So,
how old are these kids usually when they join the gangs?
It tended to be around 13 or so. It could range from 11 to 14.
And must they be from El Salvador?
No. Jessica is she's an American citizen. So her parents are from Honduras, but she was born in Long Island. So it really ranges, and they've told me that, you know, now in Hempstead you'll find these Salvadorans with pride will have kids from all over, even African-American and white kids who are members.
And what are the roles of girls in these gangs?
They're fairly limited in terms of having any power. They're often girlfriends. But in Jessica's case, she was very involved, and she was just very tough, would get involved in the fight. So she was given control of the girls in the gang. So she was a little bit more elevated. But for the most part, they don't have a lot of power.
Still, I wonder why some of these kids join gangs. They're fleeing this same sort of violence when they leave El Salvador or Honduras, other countries in Central America, and there have been wars in those countries as well, and they come here and they wind up being engaged in violent activities.
Well, and I think I do want to point out that most of the kids who've gone through this trauma of coming over here or growing up in, you know, bad neighbors don't join. I mean, for the most of the kids I interviewed at Hempstead High School didn't join gangs and had, you know, equally horrendous stories. So, I do, it's a small percentage of kids that do, but I do think, you know, if you've grown up around violence and you've seen it all your life, that's what you learn. That's how you learn to react to your, you know, your problems and your emotions.
And one of the people you write about is Julio. He actually had military training.
Yeah, and he is sort of representative of the first generation of gang members who joined in Los Angeles and afterwards. He had been in the military, I believe it was starting at age 15 or 16. And the Salvadoran military during the war, both sides, also the rebel forces during the war, recruited kids that were, you know, they were allowed to recruit kids who were 16 years old and older, but they recruited a lot of kids who were younger. So you had kids who were growing up in the army and growing up in this guerrilla war.
He was eventually deported. Is deportation the usual strategy the government uses in dealing with these kids?
Yeah, it has. There was actually a big raid last week in Texas where they deported about 100 alleged gang members. And so that's been one of the there's been prevention programs. There's some money for that, but one of the main ways of dealing with it, even under the Obama administration as well, has been Operation Community Shield, which is a immigration program to try and identify gang members and deport them either on criminal charges or just on immigration violations.
Well, what happens when they're deported back to their home countries? Haven't the LA gangs actually created new gangs in Central America that have changed the whole culture of Central America?
Well, yeah.
One of our greatest exports.
Yeah.
Better than Coca-Cola.
That's right. When a lot of these young people got home from Los Angeles, or whether it's from Los Angeles or from the East Coast, they haven't been home in years. They don't necessarily know anyone anymore. They don't have a chance at getting jobs. It's very difficult just for the people who are. That's why all the people have come here.
Don't speak English all that well in some cases.
Yeah,
I mean,
don't
Spanish anymore.
That's right. And so it's very difficult for them to adjust. Some come back. Others get into trouble there. And the prison population in El Salvador has doubled in the past decade or so. It's way over capacity, so there's not a lot there for them to do, so they join the gang again.
My guest is Sarah Garland. Her book, Gangs in Garden City, How Immigration, Segregation, and Youth Violence Are Changing America's Suburbs. It's published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How have the schools in the suburbs been dealing with the gangs?
It's been very difficult. I think at Hempstead High School, which is a troubled school anyway.
You talk about segregation here. Are these schools segregated?
Extremely segregated. Hempstead High School is more than 99% minority, and it's about a third. About a third of the students are under the poverty level, depending on the year you look at. And so it's very difficult for them because they are already struggling with a lack of resources. They're struggling with issues that segregation brings, with teachers who aren't paid as much as teachers in the school district next door, and so on. And so, for them to also be dealing with students who've gone through some of the traumas that the students from Central America have gone through, they don't have a lot there to help. So these kids tend to fall through the cracks.
Well, what impact has No Child Left Behind had on these schools with these kids?
Well, Hempstead High School was labeled a failing school, and it's done very, the administration there tried to get their act together, and they brought up the graduation rate by, I think it was about 40% several years ago, and it's now 60%, but that's still 60%. So compared to with the goal being to close the achievement gap, it's nowhere near the 99% or the 90% in neighboring districts.
Well, No Child Left Behind promised parents the option of transferring their children out of failing schools and into better funded, more successful schools. Is that even possible in some of these suburban situations?
No, it's not. In Hempstead, that's the interesting, school choice is really one of the fundamentals of No Child Left Behind. But in Hempstead, for example, you don't have a choice. You have Hempstead High School. And there is a provision where you could cross the district line and go to a school like Garden City that's doing very well and where the graduation rate is 99%. But you would have to pay for your own transportation, and Garden City would have to agree to let you in, which has not happened in the suburbs.
And some recent Supreme Court decisions have limited schools' options in engineering desegregation.
That's right. It's become very difficult after the Louisville and the Seattle Supreme Court decision that made it so that even if school districts in Long Island wanted to desegregate their school districts, they would have a hard time if they wanted to do it using race as a category.
Weren't many of these issues addressed a fairly long time ago with the Katzenbach report?
Yeah, it's interesting to read back. I read through that report. It's from the 60s, and it talks about the problem of violence as the youth population was expected to grow. So they expected violence to grow along with it. And so they talked about the need for better schools, dealing with segregation and poverty. And they had some, you know, good suggestions, but those sort of fell by the wayside in the 70s under Nixon, and a lot of the money and the hopes that had come with that were dissolved.
But then in between 1991 and 2006, violent crime rates really decreased considerably, from 758 per 100,000 to 474 per 100,000. Is that because we have taken a better approach in dealing with this kind of thing?
Well, I think, and that's one of the interesting things I look at, is how there's been a huge, a growing concern about these gangs across the country, and there's, you know, been a lot of reports, but violent crime has actually gone down. And so, you know, even as across the country, as the Hispanic population has risen in the suburbs and has grown across the country, violence has gone down, crime has gone down. So, you know, immigration, you know, it may not be directly correlated, but it certainly hasn't caused any more crime. And so, you know, it's interesting to look at how these gangs have been portrayed, and then the realities and the evidence out there showing that while they are a problem, they're certainly not as large of a problem as they've been made out to be.
Well, in 2008, the FBI ranked MS-13 as a high-level threat, and Michael Chertoff, who was then the Homeland Secretary of he was the head of Homeland Security mm-hmm. under President Bush. He regularly listed MS-13 among the top threats of the country, along with Al-Qaeda. So does that mean the federal government is deeply concerned about what's going on in Hempstead?
They actually used Hempstead as an example. Alberto Gonzalez used Hempstead as an example of a tranquil town that had been disrupted by gang violence in a speech that he gave in 2005. And so it has been a huge concern. The FBI is very focused, and particularly the FBI and the Justice Department are very focused on MS-13 in particular as a huge threat. One of the interesting things I found is, you know, they've talked about their levels of sophistication and sort of the levels of brutality, which in some, you know, there have been some very brutal crimes, but what I found in Long Island is a lot of those crimes were stabbings, so they were not using sophisticated weaponry, for example, or bat. There was a bat attack with a baseball bat, and knife attacks, and a Snapple bottle in one case was used as a weapon. So on the ground, you don't really see the level of sophistication that the law enforcement authorities at the national level have talked about. And another interesting anecdote: there was a murder in 2003 that got a lot of attention in Fairfax County, and it was an MS-13 click that their primary means of getting money was by begging for money at the mall from people who were shopping at the mall.
This is in Virginia, so these gangs have spread all over the East Coast?
Yeah, and they're largely in places where there are Central American populations, but even in Tennessee, Seattle, you know, I think in the Midwest, they've been seen.
So what happened with the panhandlers at the mall?
Well, they were supposed to be the most, you know, the scariest clique of MS-13 around. And so it sort of seemed contradictory to me.
So has this whole thing, in your estimation, been overblown by the media?
I think it has. And I think, you know, I don't think that's to say that it's not a problem that needs to be dealt with, but I think that the reaction has been to the extreme. There have been calls for crackdowns. And in Hempstead, anyway, it just really hasn't worked. They were able to arrest several of the leaders of MS-13 and basically wiped out MS-13 in Hempstead. But they have a new gang that has formed in its place, which is called Latin Pride, that the police are telling me about. So they basically got rid of one of the gangs. It's less prevalent than it was, but they have a new gang that's formed this place, so they really didn't get rid of the problem.
What impact did the 1994 law, Violent Crime Control and Enforcement Act, have on all of this? That was a bill pushed by Joe Biden, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, there was some, in that law, there was some new provisions for dealing with gang crime. And it was one of many laws that were passed in the 90s to crack down on crime in general, but also on gang crime. and on immigration, on immigrants who committed crimes. And it was, during that period you had a huge rise in the prison population, which some people argued really reduced the crime rate. But in the end, you can put a lot of people in jail, but most of them are set, about 95% of them are eventually set free. And the recidivism rate is about 70%. So you're definitely not dealing with the crime, maybe in the short term, but not in the long term.
Well, you write, in the 1800s, politicians kept gang members on their payrolls to help them get elected. In the 1990s and the first decade of the 20th century, the 21st century, politicians used gang members in more subtle ways as a crime issue that could scare votes, as evidence that they could be tough on crime when they announced a crackdown. So should we be putting them on the payroll instead?
I mean, I think that gang crackdown is always a good vote getter, I think. So I was just actually in Ireland, and they have a new gang law that they're cracking down on gangs there, and things are not going well politically and economically, so it definitely
And Sarkozy was elected president of France largely on an anti-gang plank.
That's right.
So I guess if I decide to run for president or some office, I should come out against the gangs.
That's right.
And Sarah Garland's book is called Gangs in Garden City: How Immigration, Segregation, and Youth Violence Are Changing America's Suburbs. It's published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.